Well, after this is all over and we go back to normal life, we really have to find a way to work together. There aren't many people like us, Ryan. Actually, there are, the president said after a moment's reflection. The problem is that they never come here to work. You know who I learned that from? Kathy, Jack told him. She fucks up, somebody goes blind. But she can't run away from making the call, can she? Imagine, you fuck up and somebody loses his sight forever. Or dies. The guys who work the emergency room are really on the ragged edge, like when Kathy and Sally went into shock trauma. You blow the call and somebody is gone forever. Big deal, George. Bigger than trading equities like we used to do. Same thing with cops. Same thing with soldiers. You have to make the call right now or something really bad happens. But those kinds of people don't come here to Washington, do they? And mainly that sort of guy goes to the place he or she has to be, where the real action is, Ryan said, almost wistfully. The really good ones go where they're needed, and they always seem to know where that is. But the really good ones don't like the bullshit. So they don't come here? Winston asked, getting his own course in Government 101 and finding Ryan a teacher of note. Some do. Adler at State. Another guy over there I've discovered, name of Vasco. But those are the ones who buck the system. The system works against them. Those are the ones we have to identify and protect. Mostly little ones, but what they do isn't little. They keep the system running, and mainly they go unnoticed because they don't care much about being noticed. They care about getting it done, serving the people out there. You know what I'd really like to do? Ryan asked, for the first time revealing something from the depths of his soul. He hadn't even had the guts to say this to Arnie. Yeah, set up a system that really works, a system that recognizes the good ones and gives them what they deserve. You know how hard that is in any organization? Hell, it was a struggle at my shop, and Treasury has more janitors than I had trading executives. I'm not even sure where to start a job like that, Winston said. He would be one to grasp the scope of the dream, his president thought. Harder than you think, even. The guys who really do the work don't want to be bosses. They want to work. Kathy could be an administrator. They offered her the chair at the University of Virginia Medical School, and that would have been a big deal. But it would have cut her patient time in half, and she likes doing what she does. Someday Bernie Katz at Hopkins is going to retire, and they'll offer his chair to her, and she'll turn that down. Probably, Jack thought. Unless I can talk her out of it. Can't be done, Jack. Trader shook his head. Hell of an idea, though. Grover Cleveland reformed the civil service over 100 years ago, POTUS reminded his breakfast guest. I know we can't make it perfect, but we can make it better. You're already trying. You just told me that. Think about it some. I'll do that, Sectrez promised, standing. But for now I have another revolution to foment. How many enemies can we afford to make? There's always enemies, George. Jesus had enemies. He liked the sobriquet movie star, and having learned of it 15 years before, he had also learned to make it work for him. The mission was reconnaissance, and the weapon was charm. He had a choice of accents in his repertoire. Since he had German travel documents, he affected the speech of a person from Frankfurt to go along with German clothing, complete to shoes and wallet, all purchased with money that came from whatever sponsor Ali Badrine had recently found. The rental car company had provided him with excellent maps, all spread on the bucket seat next to his. That saved him from memorizing all his routes, which was tiresome, and wasteful of both his time and his photographic memory. The first stop was St. Mary's School, located a few miles outside Annapolis. It was a religious school, Roman Catholic, that ran from pre-kindergarten to 12th grade, and had just under 600 students. That made it a borderline case in terms of economics. The star would get 2 or perhaps 3 passes, made somewhat easier by the fact that the school was on a point of land that had once been a sizable farm, which the Catholic Church had talked out of some wealthy family or other. There was only one access road. The school's land ended at the water, and there was a river on the far side past the athletic fields. The road had houses on one side, a residential development perhaps 30 years old. The school had 11 buildings, some closely bunched, others more spread out. Movie Star knew the ages of the targets, and from that it was easy enough to guess the buildings where they would spend much, if not all, of their time. The tactical environment was not a favorable one, and became less so when he spotted the protection. The school had plenty of land, at least 200 hectares, and that made for a sizable defense perimeter, penetrating which had instant risks. He spotted a total of 3 large, dark vehicles, Chevy Suburbans, which could not have been more obviously the transport for the targets and their protectors. How many? He saw 2 people standing in the open, but the vehicles would have at least 4 guards each. The vehicles would be armored and equipped with heavy weapons. 1 way in and 1 way out. Almost a kilometer out to the main road. What about the water, Movie Star thought, driving to the end? Ah, there was a Coast Guard cutter there, a small one, but it would have a radio, and that made it large enough. He stopped the car at the cul-de-sac, getting out to look at a house with a for sale sign in the yard. He retrieved the morning paper from the car, ostentatiously checking the folded page against the number, then looking around some more. He had to be quick about it. The guards would be wary, and though they couldn't check everything, even the American Secret Service had limits on its time and resources, he couldn't afford to dawdle. His initial impressions were not at all favorable. Access was limited. So many students, picking out the right 2 would be difficult. The guards were many and dispersed. That was the bad part. Numbers mattered less than physical space. The most difficult defense to breach was a defense in depth, because depth meant both space and time. You could neutralize any number of people in a matter of seconds if you had the proper weapons and they were bunched up. But give them anything more than 5 seconds, and their training would kick in. The guards would be well drilled. They'd have plans, some predictable, some not. That Coast Guard boat, for example, could dart into shore and take the targets clear. Or the guards could retreat with their charges to an isolated point and fight it out, and Movie Star had no illusions about their training and dedication. Give them as much as 5 minutes and they'd win. They'd call in help from the local police force, which even had helicopters, he'd checked, and the attacking force would be cut off. No, this was not a favored sight. He tossed the newspaper back into the car and drove off. On the way out, he looked on the street for a covert vehicle. There were a few vans parked in driveways, none of them with darkened plastic on the windows which might conceal a man with a camera. His peripheral vision confirmed his assessment. This was not a good location. To take these targets, it would be far better to do it on the fly, on the road, more correctly. But not much better. The protection for that would probably be excellent. Kevlar panels, Lexan windows, special tires, and doubtless overhead protection in the form of helicopters. That didn't even count the unmarked cars and ready access to supplementary police reinforcement. Okay, Movie Star thought, using in his mind an Americanism that had universal application. Giant Steps Daycare Center and Nursery School, Ritchie Highway above Joyce Lane. Only 1 target there, but a better one, and probably, Movie Star hoped, a more favorable tactical environment. Winston had been in the business of selling himself and his ideas for more than 20 years. Along with it had come a certain theatrical sense. Better yet, the stage fright went in both directions. Only 1 of the senators on the committee had previous experience, and he was in the minority party. The polarity of the Senate had changed with the 747 crash, and done so in his ideological favor. As a result, the men and women taking their seats behind the massive oak bench were every bit as nervous as he was. While he took his seat and set out his papers, A total of 6 people were piling up huge bound volumes on the next table over. Winston ignored them. The C-SPAN cameras did not. It soon got better. While the secretary-designate chatted with Mark Gant, the latter's portable computer open and operating in front of him, the table to their left groaned and crashed, spilling the pile of books to the floor, to the collective gasp of everyone in the room. Winston turned, startled and pleased. His gophers had done exactly what he'd told them, piling the collected volumes of the United States Tax Code right in the middle of the table, instead of distributing the load evenly.
"Oh, shit, George," Gant whispered, struggling not to laugh. "Maybe God really is on our side." He jumped up to see that nobody had been hurt. Nobody had. The first oaken cry of protest had made the people stand back. Now security guards darted in, only to see that nothing really had happened. Winston leaned into the microphone.
"Mr. Chairman, sorry about that, but it doesn't really hurt anything. Can we proceed without further delay?"
The chairman gaveled the room to order, without taking his eyes off the disaster. A minute later, George Winston was sworn.
"Do you have an opening statement, Mr. Winston?"
"Sir, I did."
Sec Trez shook his head and stifled a laugh, though not quite all the way.
"I guess I have to apologize to the members of the committee for our little accident. I'd meant that to be an illustration of one of my points, but, well..."
He rearranged his papers and sat more erect in his chair.
"Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is George Winston, and President Ryan has asked me to step away from my business to serve my country in the capacity of Secretary of the Treasury. Let me tell you a little bit about myself."
"What do we know about him?" Keelty asked.
"Plenty. He's smart, he's tough, he's pretty honest, and he's richer in God."
"Even richer than you," the aide didn't say.
"Ever investigated?"
"Never."
His chief of staff shook his head. "Maybe he's skated on thin ice, but no, Ed, I can't even say that. The book on Winston is that he plays by the rules. His investment group is highly rated for performance and integrity. He had a bad trader working for him 8 years ago, and George personally testified against him in court. He also made good the guy's shenanigans out of his own pocket. His own personal pocket, that is. $40 million worth. The crook served 5 years. He's a good choice for Ryan. He's no politician, but he's well respected on the street."
"Shit," Keelty observed.
"Mr. Chairman, there are a lot of things that need to be done."
Winston set his opening statement aside and continued off the cuff, or so it seemed. He jerked his left hand to the pile of books.
"That broken table over there, that's the U.S. tax code. It's a principle of common law that ignorance of the law is not a defense before the bar of justice. But that doesn't make sense anymore. The Treasury Department and the Internal Revenue Service both promulgate and enforce the tax law of our country. Excuse me, those laws are passed by the Congress, as we all know, but mainly they happen because my department submits the proposed set of rules, and the Congress modifies and approves them, and then we enforce them. In many cases, the interpretation of the code you pass is left to people who work for me. And as we all know, the interpretation can be as important as the laws themselves. We have special tax courts to make further rulings, but what we end up with is that pile of printed paper over there, and I would submit to this committee that nobody, not even an experienced member of the bar, can possibly understand it all. We even have the absurd situation that when a citizen brings his tax records and return forms into an IRS office for assistance from the people who enforce the law, and those IRS employees make a mistake, then the citizen who comes to his government for help is responsible for the mistakes the government makes. Now, when I was in the trading business, if I gave my client a bad piece of advice, I had to take the responsibility for it. The purpose of taxes is to provide revenue for the country's government so that the government can serve the people. But along the way, we've created an entire industry that takes billions of dollars from the public. Why? To explain a tax code that gets more complex every year. A code that the enforcement people themselves do not understand with a sufficient degree of confidence to undertake responsibility for getting it right. You already know, or you should, they didn't, the amount of money we spend on enforcing that tax code. And that's not especially productive either. We're supposed to be working for the people, not confusing them. And so, Mr. Chairman, there are some things I hope to be able to accomplish during my term at Treasury, if the committee sees fit to confirm my nomination. First, I want the tax code completely rewritten into something a normal person can understand. I want that tax code to make sense. I want a code with no special breaks. I want the same rules to apply equally to everybody. I am prepared to present a proposal to do exactly that. I want to work with the committee to make that into law. I want to work with you, ladies and gentlemen. I will not let any corporate or any other form of lobbyist into my office to discuss this matter, and here and now I beseech you to do the same. Mr. Chairman, when we start talking to every Tom, Dick, and Harry who has a little suggestion to take care of a special group with special needs, we end up with that. Winston pointed to the broken table again. We're all Americans. We're supposed to work together, and in the long run, tweaking the tax laws of our country for every lobbyist with an office and a clientele ultimately takes more money from everybody. The laws of our country are not supposed to be a jobs program for accountants and lawyers in the private sector, and bureaucrats in the public sector. The laws which you pass, and which people like me enforce, are supposed to serve the needs of the citizens, not the needs of the government. Second, I want my department to run efficiently. Efficiency is not a word that government knows how to spell, much less implement. That has to change. Well, I can't change this whole city, but I can change the department with which the President has entrusted me, and which I hope you will let me have. I know how to run a business. The Columbus Group serves literally millions of people, directly and indirectly, and I've borne that burden with pride. I will, in the next few months, submit a budget for a Department of the Treasury that doesn't have so much as one excess position. It was a considerable exaggeration, but nonetheless an impressive one. This room has heard such claims before, and I will not blame you for taking my words with a ton of salt, but I am a man accustomed to backing up my words with results, and that's going to happen here too. President Ryan had to yell at me to get me to move into Washington. "I don't like it here, Mr. Chairman," Winston told the committee. He had them now. "I want to do my job and leave. But the job is going to get done if you let me." That concludes my opening statement. The most experienced people in the room were the reporters in the second row. The first row had Winston's wife and family. They knew how things were done and how things were said. A cabinet officer was supposed to wax rhapsodic about the honor of being allowed to serve, about the joy of being entrusted with power, about the responsibility that would bear heavily upon him or her. "I don't like it here." The reporters stopped writing their notes and looked up, first at the dais and then at one another. Movie star liked what he saw. Though the danger to him was greater, the risk was balanced. Here there was a main four-lane highway within a few meters of the objective, and that led to an infinite network of side roads. Best of all, you could see almost everything. Directly behind the objective was a clump of woods, dense enough that it could not hold a support vehicle. There had to be one, and where would it be? There, he thought. There was one house close enough with an attached garage that actually faced the daycare center, and that one, yes. Two cars parked right in front of that house. Why weren't they parked inside? So probably the Secret Service had made an arrangement with the owners. It was ideal, 50 meters from the Demi School, facing in the right direction. If something untoward happened,
the alarm would be issued, and the support vehicle would instantly be manned. The garage door opened, and out it would race like a tank, except that it wasn't a tank. The problem with security in a case such as this was that you had to set your procedures in stone, and clever as the Secret Service people undoubtedly were, their arrangements had to fit parameters both known and predictable. He checked his watch. How to confirm his suspicions? For starters, he needed a few minutes at rest. Directly across from Giant Steps was a convenience store, and that he'd check, because the enemy would have a person there, maybe more than one. He pulled in, parked the car, and went in, spending a minute or so blundering about. "Can I help you?" a voice asked. Female, 25. No older than that, but trying to look young. One did that with the cut of the hair and a little makeup, movie star knew. He'd used female operatives himself, and that's what he told them. Younger people always appear less threatening, especially the females. With a smile of confusion and embarrassment, he walked to the counter. "I'm looking for your maps," he said. "Right there, under the counter." The clerk pointed with a smile. She was Secret Service. The eyes were too bright for the person to be in such a menial job. "Ah," he said in disgust, selecting a large book map that would show every residential street in the district. County, they called them in America. He lifted it and flipped pages, one eye trained across the street. The children were being led outside to the playground. Four adults with them. Two would have been the normal number. So at least two. Three, he realized, spotting a man in the shadows, hardly moving at all. Large man, 180 centimeters or so, wearing casual clothes. Yes, the playground faced the dwelling with the garage. The watchers had to be there. Two more, perhaps three, would be in the dwelling, always watching. This would not exactly be easy, but he would know where the opposition was. "How much for the map?" "Printed right there on the cover." "Ach, ja, excuse me." He reached into his pocket. $5.95, he said to himself, fishing for the change. "Plus tax." She rang it up on the register. "Are you new to the area?" "Yes, I am. I am teacher." "Oh, what do you teach?" "German," he replied, taking his change and counting it. "I want to see what houses are like here. Thank you for the map. I have much to do." A curt European nod punctuated the encounter, and he left without a further look across the street. Movie star had a sudden chill. The clerk had definitely been a police type. She'd be watching him right now, probably taking down his license number. But if she did, and if the Secret Service ran the number, they'd find that his name was Dieter Kolb, a German citizen from Frankfurt, a teacher of English, currently out of the country, and unless they pressed, that cover would be sufficient. He pulled north on Ritchie Highway, turning right at the first opportunity. There was a community college on a hill nearby, and in America those all had parking lots. It was just a matter of finding a good spot. This was it. The intervening woods would soon fill out with the coming of spring, blocking visual access to Giant Steps. The rear of the house, whose garage probably held the Chevy Suburban support vehicle, had only a few windows facing in this direction, and those were curtained. The same was true of the preschool itself. Movie star, slash Kolb, lifted a pair of compact binoculars and scanned. It wasn't easy with all the tree trunks between him and the objective, but thorough as the American Secret Service was, its people weren't perfect. None were. More to the point, Giant Steps was not a favorable location for quartering so important a child. But that wasn't surprising. The Ryan family had sent all of its children here. The teachers were probably excellent, and Ryan and his physician wife probably knew them and were friendly with them. And the news stories he'd copied down from the Internet emphasized the fact that the Ryans wanted to keep their family life intact. Very human. And foolish. He watched the children cavort on the playground. It seemed to be covered with wood chips. How natural it all was, the little ones cocooned in bulky winter clothes. The temperature was 11 or 12, he estimated. And running about, some on the monkey bars, others on swings, still more playing in what dirt they could find. The manner of dress told him that these children were well looked after, and they were, after all, children. Except for one. Which one, he couldn't tell from this distance. They'd need photos for that, when the time came. But that one wasn't a child at all. That one was a political statement for someone to make. Who would make the statement, and exactly why the statement would be made, didn't concern movie star. He'd remain in his perch for several hours, not thinking at all about what might result from his activities. Or might not. He didn't care. He'd write up his memorized notes, draw his detailed maps and diagrams, and forget about it. Kolb was years past caring about it all. What had begun with religious fervor for the liberating holy war of his people had, with the passage of time, become work for which he was paid. If, in the end, something happened which he found politically beneficial, so much the better. But somehow that had never taken place, despite all the hopes and dreams and fiery rhetoric. And what sustained him was the work and his skill at it. How strange, movie star thought, that it should have become so. But the passionate ones were mainly dead, victims of their own dedication. His face grimaced at the irony of it. The true believers done in by their own passion, and those who sustained the hope of his people were those who didn't care anymore? Was that true? Many people will object to the nature of your proposed tax plan. A really fair plan is progressive, the senator went on. Predictably, he was one of the survivors, not one of the new arrivals. He had the mantra down. Doesn't this place rather a high burden on working Americans? Senator, I understand what you're saying, Winston replied after taking a sip from his water glass. But what do you mean when you say working Americans? I work. I built my business from the ground up, and believe me, that's work. The First Lady, Kathy Ryan, makes something like $400,000 per year. Much more than her husband, I might add. Does that mean she doesn't work? I think she does. She's a surgeon. I have a brother who's a physician, and I know the hours he works. True, those two people make more than the average American does, but the marketplace has long since decided that the work they do is more valuable than what some other people do. If you're going blind, a union auto worker can't help you. Neither can a lawyer. A physician can. That doesn't mean that the physician doesn't work, Senator. It means that the work requires higher qualifications and much longer training, and that as a result the work is more highly compensated. What about a baseball player? That's another category of skilled work. And nobody in this room objects to the salary paid Ken Griffey Jr., for example. Why? Because he's superb at what he does. One of the what, 4 or 5 best in the entire world? And he is lavishly compensated for it. Again, that's the marketplace at work. In a broader sense, speaking in my capacity as a mere citizen instead of a secretary-designate, I object strongly to the artificial and mainly false dichotomy that some people in the political arena place between blue-collar and white-collar workers. There is no way to earn an honest living in this country except by providing a product or a service to the public. And, generally speaking, the harder and smarter you work, the more money you make. It's just that some people have greater abilities than others. If there is an idle-rich class in America, I think the only place you find them is in the movies. Who in this room, if you had the choice, would not instantly trade places with Ken Griffey or Jack Nicklaus? Don't all of us dream about being that good at something? I do, Winston admitted, but I can't swing a bat that hard. Okay, what about a really talented software engineer? I can't do that either. What about an inventor? What about an executive who transforms a company from a loser to a profit maker? Remember what Samuel Gomper said?
The worst failure of a captain of industry is to fail to show a profit. Why? Because a profitable company is one that does its job well, and only those companies can compensate their workers properly, and at the same time return money to their shareholders. And those are the people who invest their money in the company which generated jobs for its workers. Senator, the thing we forget is why we're here and what we're trying to do. The government doesn't provide productive jobs. That's not what we're supposed to do. General Motors and Boeing and Microsoft are the ones who employ workers to turn out products the people need. The job of government is to protect the people, to enforce the law, and to make sure people play by the rules, like the umpires on a ball field. It's not supposed to be our job, I think, to punish people for playing the game well. We collect taxes so that the government can perform its functions. But we've gotten away from that. We should collect those taxes in such a way as to do minimum harm to the economy as a whole. Taxes are, by their very nature, a negative influence, and we can't get away from that. But what we can do is at least structure the tax system in such a way that it does minimum harm, and maybe even encourages people to use their money in such a way as to encourage the overall system to work. I know where you're going. You're going to talk about cutting capital gains taxes, but that benefits only the few at the cost of... Senator, excuse me for interrupting, but that simply is not true, and you know it's not true, Winston chided brusquely. Reducing the rate of tax on capital gains means the following. It encourages people to invest their money. No, let me back up a little. Let's say I make $1,000. I pay taxes on that money, pay my mortgage, pay for food, pay for the car, and what I have left I invest in, XYZ computer company. XYZ takes my money and hires somebody. That person works at his job like I work at mine. And from what work he does, he's making a product which the public likes and buys, right? The company generates a profit, which the company shares with me. That money is taxed as regular income. Then I sell the stock and buy into another company so that it can hire somebody else. The money realized from selling the stock issue is capital gains. People don't put their money under the mattress anymore, he reminded them, and we don't want them to. We want them to invest in America, in their fellow citizens. Now, I've already paid tax on the money which I invested, right? Okay, then I help give some fellow citizen a job. That job makes something for the public. And for helping give a worker a job, and for helping that worker make something for the public, I get a modest return. That's good for that worker I helped to hire, and good for the public. Then I move on to do the same thing somewhere else. Why punish me for that? Doesn't it make more sense to encourage people to do that? And remember, we've already taxed that investment money once anyway. In actual practice, more than once. That isn't good for the country. It's bad enough that we take so much, but the manner in which we take it is egregiously counterproductive. Why are we here, Senator? We're supposed to be helping things along, not hurting. And the net result, remember, is a tax system so complicated that we need to collect billions to administer it. And that money is totally wasted. Toss in all the accountants and tax lawyers who make their living off something the public can't understand, Sectrez concluded. America isn't about envy. America isn't about class rivalry. We don't have a class system in America. Nobody tells an American citizen what they can do. Birth doesn't count for much. Look at the committee members. Son of a farmer, son of a teacher, son of a truck driver, son of a lawyer. You, Senator Nicolaides, son of an immigrant. If America was a class-defined society, then how the heck did you people get here? He demanded. His current questioner was a professional politician, son of another, not to mention an arrogant son of a bitch, Winston thought, and didn't get classified. Everyone he'd just pointed to quelled a little at being singled out for the cameras. Gentlemen, let's try and make it easier for people to do what we've all done. If we have to skew the system, then let's do it in such a way that it encourages our fellow citizens to help one another. If America has a structural economic problem, it's that we don't generate as many opportunities as we should and can do. The system isn't perfect. Fine, let's try to fix it some. That's why we're all here. "But the system must demand that everyone pay their fair share," the senator said, trying to take the floor back. "What does fair mean? In the dictionary, it means that everyone has to do about the same. 10% of $1 million is still 10 times more than 10% of $100,000, and 20 times more than 10% of $50,000. But fairness, in the tax code, has come to mean that we take all the money we can from successful people and dole it back. And, oh, by the way, those rich people hire lawyers and lobbyists who talk to people in the political arena and get 1 million special exceptions written into the system so that they don't get totally fleeced. And they don't, and we all know that. And what do we end up with?"
Winston waved his hand at the pile of books on the floor of the committee room. "We end up with a jobs program for bureaucrats and accountants and lawyers and lobbyists, and somewhere along the way the tax-paying citizens are just plain forgotten. We don't care that they can't make sense of the system that's supposed to serve them. It's not supposed to be that way."
Winston leaned into the microphone. "I'll tell you what I think fair means. I think it means that we all bear the same burden in the same proportion. I think it means that the system not only allows but encourages us to participate in the economy. I think it means that we promulgate simple and comprehensible laws so that people know where they stand. I think fair means that it's a level playing field, and everybody gets the same breaks, and that we don't punish Ken Griffey for hitting home runs. We admire him. We try to emulate him. We try to make more like him. And we keep out of his way."
"Let him eat cake," the chief of staff said.
"We can't say hot dogs, can we?" Keelty asked. Then he smiled broadly.
"Finally."
"Finally," another aide agreed.
The results were all equivocal. The FBI polygrapher had been working all morning, and every single set of tracings on the fanfold paper was iffy. It couldn't be helped. An all-night session, they'd all told him, looking into something important which he wasn't cleared for. That made it the Iran-Iraq situation, of course. He could watch CNN as well as anyone. The men he'd put on the box were all tired and irritable, and some had fluttered badly on telling him their proper names and job descriptions, and the whole exercise had been useless, probably.
"Did I pass?" Rutledge asked, when he took off the pressurized armband in the manner of someone who'd done this all before.
"Well, I'm sure you've been told before. It's not a pass-or-fail examination process," the Undersecretary of State said tiredly.
"Yeah, tell that to somebody who lost his clearance because of a session on the box. I hate the damn things, always have."
It was right up or down there with being a dentist, the FBI agent thought. And though he was one of the best around at this particular black art, he'd learned nothing this day that would help the investigation.
"The session you had last night..."
Rutledge cut him off cold.
"Can't discuss it, sorry."
"No, I mean, this sort of thing normal here?"
"It will be for a while, probably."
"Look, you know what it's about, probably."
The agent nodded, and the undersecretary did the same.
"Fine. Then you know it's a big deal, and we're going to be burning a lot of midnight oil over it, especially my people. So lots of coffee and long hours and short tempers." He checked his watch.
"My working group gets together in 10 minutes. Anything else?"
"No, sir."
"Thanks for a fun 90 minutes, Rutledge said, heading for the door.
It was so easy. You just had to know how the things worked. They wanted relaxed and peaceful subjects to get proper results. The polygraph essentially measured tension induced by awkward questions. So make everybody tense. That was simple enough. And really, the Iranians were doing the work. All he had to do was stoke the fires a little. That was good for a smile as he entered the executive washroom.
There. Movie star checked his watch and made a further mental note. 2 men walked out of the private dwelling. One of them turned to say something as he closed the door. They walked to the parking lot of Giant Steps, eyes scanning around in a way that identified them as positively as uniforms and rifles.
The Chevy Suburban emerged from the private garage. A good hiding place, but a little too obvious to the skilled observer. Two children came out together, one led by a woman, the other by a man. Yes, the one who'd been in the shadowed doorway when they'd gone out for their afternoon playtime. Large man, formidable one. Two women, one in front, one behind. All the heads turning and scanning. They took the child to a plain car. The Suburban halted in front of the driveway, and the other cars followed it down the highway with a police car he saw 15 seconds behind. It would be a difficult task, but not an impossible one, and the mission had several different outcomes, all acceptable to his patrons. Just as well that he didn't get sentimental about children. He'd been involved in such missions before, and you simply couldn't look at them as children at all. The one who'd been led by the large hand of her bodyguard was what he'd decided before, a political statement to be made by someone else. Allah would not have approved. Movie star knew that. There was not a religion in the world that sanctioned harm to a child, but religions were not instruments of statecraft, regardless of what Badrine's current superior might believe. Religions were something for an ideal world, and the world wasn't ideal. And so one might use unusual means to serve religious goals, and that meant something he simply didn't think about. It was business, his business, to see what could be done, rules or not. And movie star wasn't the least bit sanctimonious about it, which he thought was probably why he was still alive while others were not. And if he read this properly, still others would not be. Chapter 28. But a Whimper. Politicians rarely like surprises. Much as they enjoy dropping them on others, mainly other politicians, usually in public, and invariably delivered with all the care and planning of a jungle ambush, they reciprocally detest being on the receiving end. And that was just the political sort, in countries where politics was a fairly civilized business. In Turkmenistan, things had not gotten that far yet. The premier, he had a wide variety of titles to choose from, and he liked this one better than president, enjoyed everything about his life and his office. As a chieftain of the semi-departed Communist Party, he would have lived under greater personal restrictions than were now the case, and would always be at the end of a telephone line to Moscow, like a brookfish at the end of a long leader. But not now. Moscow no longer had the reach, and he had become too large a fish. He was a vigorous man in his late 50s, and, as he liked to joke, a man of the people. The people, in this case, had been an attractive clerk of 20 years, who, after an evening of fine dining and a little ethnic dancing, at which he excelled, had entertained him as only a young woman could. And now he was driving back to his official residence under a clear starry sky, sitting in the right front seat of his black Mercedes with the sated smile of a man who'd just proven that that's what he was in the best possible way. Perhaps he'd wangle a promotion for the girl in a few weeks. His was the exercise of, if not absolute power, then surely enough for any man, and with that came near utter contentment. Popular with his people as an earthy, common folk sort of leader, he knew how to act, how to sit with the people, how to grasp a hand or a shoulder, always in front of TV cameras to show that he was one of them. Cult of personality was what the former regime had called it, and that's what it was, and that, he knew for sure, was what all politics had to be. His was a great responsibility, and he met that duty, and in return he was owed some things. One of them was this fine German automobile. Smuggling that into the country had been an exercise in panache rather than corruption. And another was now returning to her bed with a smile and a sigh. And life was good. He didn't know he had less than 60 seconds of it left.
He didn't bother with a police escort. His people loved him. He was sure of that, too. And besides, it was late. But there was a police car, he saw, at an intersection, its light turning and flashing, blocking the way, just beyond the cross street. A dismounted policeman raised his hand while talking into his radio, hardly even looking at them. The premier wondered what the problem was. His driver, bodyguard, slowed the Mercedes with an annoyed snort, stopping it right in the intersection and making sure his pistol was readily accessible. Barely had the official car stopped when both of them heard a noise to their right. The premier turned that way, and scarcely had time for his eyes to go wide before the Zeal 157 truck hit him at 40 kilometers per hour. The high military-style bumper hit just at the bottom of the door glass, and the official car was thrown 10 meters to the left, stopping when it hit the stone walls of an office building. Then it was time for the policeman to walk over, assisted by two others who had appeared from the shadows. The driver was dead from a broken neck. The policeman could see that from the angle of his head, and one of them reached through the shattered windshield to shake it around, just to make sure. But the premier, to everyone's astonishment, was still moaning, despite his injuries. Due to all the drink, they thought, his body limp and limber. Well, that was easily fixed. The senior cop walked to the truck, flipped open the toolbox, took a tire iron, returned, and smashed it against the side of his premier's head just forward of the ear. That task completed, he tossed the tool back to the truck driver, and the premier of Turkmenistan was dead as the result of an auto accident. Well, then, their country would have to have elections, wouldn't it? That would be something of a first, and it would call for a leader whom the people knew and respected.
"Senator, it's been a long day," Tony Brentano agreed. "And it's been rather a long couple of weeks for me, learning the ropes and meeting the people. But, you know, management is management, and the Department of Defense has been without it for quite some time. I am especially concerned with the procurement system. It takes too long and costs too much. The problem isn't so much corruption as an attempt to impose a standard of fairness so exacting that, well, as a pedestrian example, if you bought food the way DOD is forced to buy weapons, you'd starve to death in the supermarket while trying to decide between Libby and Del Monte pears. TRW is an engineering company, and to my way of thinking, a very good one. There's no way I could run my company like this. My stockholders would lynch me. We can do better, and I intend to see that we do."
"Mr. Secretary-designate," the senator asked, "how much longer does this have to go on? We just won a war, and—"
"Senator, America has the best medical care in the world, but people still die from cancer and heart disease. The best isn't always good enough, is it? But more than that, and more to the point, we can do better for less money. I am not going to come to you with a request for increased overall funding. Acquisition funding will have to be higher, yes. Training and readiness will be higher also. But the real money in defense goes out in personnel costs, and that is where we can make a difference. The whole department is overmanned in the wrong places. That wastes the taxpayers' money. I know. I pay a lot of taxes. We do not utilize our people effectively, and nothing, Senator, is more wasteful than that. I think I can promise you a net reduction of 2 or 3%. Maybe more if I can get a handle on the acquisition system. For the latter, I need statutory assistance. There's no reason why we have to wait 8 to 12 years to field a new airplane. We study things to death. That was once meant to save money, and maybe once it was a good idea, but now we spend more money on studies than we do on real R&D. It's time to stop inventing the wheel every 2 years. Our citizens work for the money we spend, and we owe it to them to spend it intelligently.
Most important of all, when America sends her sons and daughters into harm's way, they must be the best trained, best supported, best equipped forces we can put into the field. The fact of the matter is that we can do that and save money also, by making the system work more efficiently.
The nice thing about this new crop of senators, Brentano reflected, was they didn't know what was impossible. He would never have gotten away with what he'd just said as recently as a year earlier. Efficiency was a concept foreign to most government agencies, not because there was anything wrong with the people, but because nobody had ever told them to do better. There was much to be said for working at the place that printed the money, but there was much to be said for eating eclairs, too, until your arteries clogged up. If the heart of America were its government, the nation would long since have fallen over dead. Fortunately, his country's heart was elsewhere, and surviving on healthier food.
But why do we need so much defense in an age when... Brentano cut him off again. It was a habit he'd have to break, which he knew even as he did it. But this was too much. Senator, have you checked the building across the street lately? It was amusing to see the way the man's head jerked back, even though the aide to Brentano's left flinched almost as badly. That senator had a vote, both on the committee and on the floor of the Senate chamber, which was still open for business now that they'd gotten the smoke out of the building. But the point got across to most of the others, and the SecDef was willing to settle for that. In due course, the chairman gaveled the session to a close, and scheduled a vote for the following morning. The senators had already made their votes clear with their praise for Brentano's forthright and positive statement, pledging their desire to work with him in words almost as naive as his own. And with that, another day ended on one place, with a new one soon to begin in another. No sooner had the UN resolution passed than the first ship had sailed for the brief steam to the Iraqi port of Bushehr, there to be unloaded by the huge vacuum cleaner-like structures. And, from that point on, things had gone quickly. For the first morning in many years, there would be bread enough on the breakfast tables of Iraq for everyone. Morning television proclaimed the fact for all, with the predictable live shots of neighborhood bakeries selling off their wares to happy, smiling crowds, and then concluding with word that the new revolutionary government was meeting today to discuss other matters of national importance. These signals were duly copied down at Palm Bowl and Storm Track and passed along. But the real news that day came from another source.
Golovko told himself that the Turkoman premier might well have died in an accident. His personal proclivities were well known to the RVS, and vehicle accidents were hardly unknown in his country or any other. In fact, auto mishaps had been hugely disproportionate in the Soviet Union, especially those associated with drink.
But Golovko had never been one to believe in coincidences of any sort, most particularly those which happened in ways and at times inconvenient to his country. It didn't help that he had ample assets in place to diagnose the problem. The premier was dead. There would be elections. The likely winner was obvious because the departed politician had been wonderfully effective stifling political opposition. And now, also, he saw, Iranian military units were forming up for road marches to their west. Two dead chiefs of state, in such a short time, within such a short radius, both in countries bordering Iran. No, even if it had been a coincidence, he would not have believed it. With that, Golovko changed hats, the Western aphorism, and lifted his phone. USS Pasadena was positioned between two PRC surface action groups, currently operating about 9 miles apart. The submarine had a full load of weapons, warshots all. But for all that, it was rather like being the only cop in Times Square at midnight on New Year's, trying to keep track of everything at the same time. Having a loaded gun didn't amount to very much. Every few minutes he deployed his ESM mast to get a feel for the electronic signals being radiated about, and his sonar department also fed data to the tracking party in the after portion of the attack center. As many men as could fit around the chart table were busily keeping tabs on the various contacts. The skipper ordered his boat to go deep, to 300 feet, just below the layer, so that he could take a few minutes to examine the plot, which had become far too complex for him to keep it all in his head. With the boat steadied up on her new depth, he took the 3 steps aft to look. It was a Fleet-X, but the type of Fleet-X wasn't quite... Ordinarily, one group played the good guys against the theoretical bad guys in the other group, and you could tell what was what by the way the ships were arrayed. Instead of orienting toward each other, however, both groups were oriented to the east. This was called the threat axis, meaning the direction from which the enemy was expected to strike. To the east lay the Republic of China, which comprised mainly the island of Taiwan. The senior chief operations specialist supervising the plot was marking up the acetate overlay, and the picture was about as clear as it needed to be. "Con sonar," came the next call. "Con eye," the captain acknowledged, taking the microphone. "Two new contacts, sir, designate Sierra 20 and 21. Both appear to be submerged contacts. Sierra 20, bearing 325, direct path and feint. Stand by." "Okay, looks like a Han-class SSN. Good cut on the 50 hertz line. Plant noise also. 21, also submerged contact, at 330. Starting to look like a Shia, sir."
"A boomer in a Fleet X?" the senior chief wondered.
"How good's the cut on 21?
"Improving now, sir," the sonar chief replied.
The entire sonar crew was in their compartment, just forward of the attack center on the starboard side.
"Plant noise says Shia to me, Cap'n. The Han is maneuvering south, bearing now 321. Getting a blade rate. Call it speed 18 knots.
"Sir?"
The operations chief made a quick notional plot. The SSN and the boomer would be behind the northern surface group.
"Anything else, sonar?" the captain asked.
"Sir, getting a little complicated with all these tracks."
"Tell me about it," someone breathed at the tracking table while making another change.
"Anything to the east?" the CO persisted.
"Sir, easterly, we have 6 contacts, all classified as merchant traffic."
"We got 'em all here, sir," the operations chief confirmed. "Nothing yet from the Taiwan Navy."
"That's gonna change," the captain thought aloud. General Bondarenko didn't believe in coincidences either. More than that, the southern part of the country, once known as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, held little charm for him. His time in Afghanistan and a frantic night in Tajikistan had seen to that. In the abstract, he would not have minded the total divorce of the Russian Republic from the Muslim proto-nations arrayed on his country's southern border, but the real world wasn't abstract.
"So what do you think is going on?" the general lieutenant asked.
"Are you briefed in on Iraq?"
"Yes, I am, Comrade Chairman."
"Then you tell me, Gennady Yosefovich," Golovko commanded.
Bondarenko leaned across the map table and spoke while moving a finger about.
"I would say that what concerns you is the possibility that Iran is making a bid for superpower status. In uniting with Iraq, they increase their oil wealth by something like 40%. Moreover, that would give them contiguous borders with Kuwait and the Saudi kingdom. The conquest of those nations would redouble their wealth. One may safely assume that the lesser nations would fall as well. The objective circumstances here are self-evident," the general went on, speaking in the calm voice of a professional soldier analyzing disaster.
"Combined, Iran and Iraq outnumber the combined populations of the other states by a considerable margin. 5-1, Comrade Chairman? More? I do not recall exactly, but certainly the manpower advantage is decisive, which would make outright conquest or at least great political influence likely. That alone would give this new United Islamic Republic enormous economic power, the ability to choke off the energy supply to Western Europe and Asia at will.
Now, Turkmenistan. If this is, as you suspect, not a coincidence, then we see that Iran wishes to move north also, perhaps to absorb Azerbaijan." His finger traced along the map. "Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, at least part of Kazakhstan. That would triple their population, add a significant resource base to their United Islamic Republic, and next, one assumes, Afghanistan and Pakistan. and we have a new nation stretching from the Red Sea to the Hindu Kush. And yet, more to the point, from the Red Sea to China.